Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Present at the table are Senator Meyer, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, Senator Faircloth, and myself, Senator Kelly. We're going to hear an overview from the University of Alaska today. The main presenter will be President Gamble. President Gamble, if you'd like to step up. We'll hold questions if we could. Let the President get through. Yes, please, Michelle, as well, come up. Let's let President Gamble get through the presentation and hold questions till the end, if we could. That's all right with the committee. And with that, get your cup of coffee there, Mr. President. The committee is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pat Gamble, and I'm the president of the University of Alaska System. And with me this morning is Ms. Michelle Rizik, who has been the director of budget for the university for several years and is now also holding down the position as the temporary director of human relations for the university system while we go through the search for an incumbent in that position. We also have Chris Christensen with us, who is our legislative liaison and a well-known face around the Hill here for many years. We're lucky to have Chris, and this is our second year with Chris. I have a budget overview this morning, and I believe, with maybe the exception of two of the members, you all are familiar over the last 2 years of the sequence of budget events that's led up to this budget, where we've talked about going out and assessing the needs of the state of Alaska, comparing it with what we're doing in the university, realizing that after going out and looking at reports that were done on the university, going out and talking with all these outreach meetings all across the state, talking with students, faculty, staff, and so on, we got a pretty good list, that about 200 pages worth of pretty good comments about what we could do better in the university, what we were doing good, and ideas about how we could be more efficient, more effective. We group those under five themes, and for the first year, this budget is focused directly at those five themes. Now, instead of going and putting band-aids on everything that we found wrong, as I explained it last year, we were just getting started in a thing we called SDI, and you'll see that referenced in this briefing, the Strategic Direction Initiative, which was, in fact, instead of going out and looking at the eaches of everything that everybody suggested for us and then fixing them one at a time, we wanted to take a more holistic view, get our arms around some of these comments and recommendations and see how many of them were interconnected, tie those together, and take a look at a more holistic approach at systematically going in and fixing the university in a way that was enduring and lasting, not temporary band-aids. And we've come a long way in the last year since I was able to talk to this committee. And last year, Representative Faircloth, we had a lot of in-depth hearings going on in the House Finance where we talked about a lot of this. And in this budget today, and we may not get to all of it because there's a lot that's going on in the last year, but in these charts, you will see the initiatives that have begun and are underway that did not exist last year when we were here at the same time. We were talking about going to do them this year, we're doing them, and there's a lot more coming down the road. We're about two-thirds of the way through this initiative we call SDI. We've probably got the hardest part, and that is a statement of what the effect is in a particular theme area of these five themes. What's the effect we want to achieve, for example, in transfer of credits? Yeah, we want the credits to transfer, but overall in the system, what is the overall system effect that we want in place when we're done fixing transfer of credits? To get that statement right is very important, because how we get to that point then is going to be the path that we're going to decide on and actually put into place and put into action. So we need to get the effect statement right in order to get the fix right. And that's the stage we're just entering in right now, and probably the more interesting but also the most difficult phase of this project. And as I said, we're just ending phase two out of a three-phase project, this SDI. When we make these corrections, SDI as a project or a program goes away. It just withers away. There's no more need for it because we are, if you will, newly invigorated, newly minted. It's a different university approach in so many areas that it doesn't have a name anymore, or it's not a program anymore. It's who we are. And that's the intended outcome of this whole SDI effort. And we'll talk here and there through the briefing. We're going to have to go fast. There's a lot in this briefing that we probably won't mention. If you have questions, please, on anything, obviously we can stop and back up and discuss those in more detail. And with that, we'll start. I always start off, I do this every year, you know, here's where we are. We're all over the state. We've got three main universities, separately accredited university campuses, underneath which there are our community campuses and the community college at Prince William Sound in Valdez. Here's the system-wide organizational chart. This is the system staff. And what it shows are the three main university and then the community campuses underneath the universities, for those that are not familiar with our alignment. The mission, the only thing I'd say again to emphasize is there's some key words in here. Teaching, and we'll talk about this today, the business of teaching is really undergoing some revolution right now. And there's a lot of controversy about new ways of teaching, about new ideas. And underlying it all is technology, and the refresh rate of technology is much faster than the old ways of teaching, lecturing in a lecture hall. And as a result, the tempo of change has picked up, and it's interesting. 235 years, we've basically taught the same way by lecturing in a classroom, and today there are so many different ideas floating around about how to connect with students. And most of it has to do with technology. And there's a revolution going on in higher education. And clearly, that's finding its way down into secondary school as well. And then public service, our community campuses are closely tied and very important to the cause. The North, we have a niche in Alaska with regard to things like research that we can be competitive with any school in the entire country, no matter who they are or where they are. Because we know the Arctic, and we know Alaska, we know fisheries, we know mining, and we've got great researchers, great grad students, and great classes that I can go into more detail. But the really proof of the pudding is when you go out for a competitive research grant and beat out all the other major schools in the country in order to win a multi-million dollar grant for an Alaskan effort for research, that's really saying something, and we've been quite successful in the last year in doing that. So I think there's a lot of our future to be had in the growth of research. And then finally, diverse peoples. We've got a responsibility to protect and enhance our culture, and things like the preservation of language in Alaska, that's the business of the university, and we can't, no matter how modern we think we want to get, forget that that is a part of our mission as well. A little bit about some of our demographics. This is what we do. In the last year, UAA has become a doctoral university now in terms of the categories of universities. It's moved up from a master's level to a doctoral level with its first joint doctoral program with UAF. Normally, this is the way we look at ourselves at the end of the year, these real high-level metrics. And the reason I put this chart up here is because with the red and the yellow, what this is really showing overall is that we're sort of peaking after about 10 to 12 years of consistent growth. Year after year after year, we've come in asking for money that represents growth in programs, growth in faculty, growth in staff, growth in buildings. Those days are over. In fact, in our capital budget, you will see that there is not a penny of future planning for facilities, for example, in our capital budget this year. We've got plenty to fill our capital needs that still is yet to be done before we go building new buildings. And besides, we've been generously endowed with not only general bond funds from the public, but the support that we received, particularly last year from the legislature, and we're building new buildings, we've recently received some. So I would say in that sense, we're in good shape. Deferred maintenance is another subject, however, and we'll talk about that. But really, this shows we're peaking. We're flattening out. There's some good news stories in here, like our vet med program that started up with Colorado State, our honors programs, which you funded last year, and the number of students that are in our honors programs in 1 year is just amazing. These are the top college students in Alaska. Course loading is going up. Students are taking more hours, even though we're seeing reductions in the headcount and reductions in the overall number of credit hours. Those students who are seeking a four-year degree are actually taking more hours than they were. And that's a very good sign because, as you know, you get through cheaper and you get through faster if you take more hours. Here's a list of challenges. I could probably write down several lists of challenges, but this is just a cross-section to let you know the environment that we're working in. We expect federal funding support to trend down, particularly in research. We can take a guess at what sequestration would do for us in terms of the potential for budget cuts, but we really don't know what's going to happen at the national level. State funding support, as I said, is problematic with the state budgets that you're dealing with, and we're the third largest bill you pay, and we're going to be probably affected by the decisions that are made. The facility complex, you probably know all about that. Bandwidth, down at the very bottom, I would just mention that it has become so second nature to assume that whatever you want to get in terms of information these days, you're going to have access to it, either through a handheld device, through a laptop, through an iPad. You're just going to have it available. And when you don't, you realize that you're actually dividing out a class of haves and have-nots. And in the education world, as we're relying more and more on applications that are online, not only the bandwidth, but the latency that goes with it. And by latency, I mean if you've ever tried to run a YouTube and it's or streaming audio, and it stops, breaks up, and then you get the buffer signal, buffering. That's bandwidth and latency at work. And if you're a student taking a final exam online or doing a lab online and you start having those kinds of problems, you can't take the course effectively. And so bandwidth for education is very, very important. In fact, it's like runways for airplanes and highways for trucks. You got to have the bandwidth today or you're just not a player. And in education, for Alaskans, that's going to be very, very important. And there are initiatives going on in the interior. I know ACS has got some. There's a Canadian firm coming in. They want to join more fiber, complete the loop, if you will, through the state of Alaska. There's a number of initiatives. But the real question is, how much of all of that is the university supposed to pay for as opposed to connecting into the basic bandwidth that's available to the community and pay for the last 100 yards to hook up the students and the libraries and so on? Right now, we're expected to pay for the whole thing if we want to hook bandwidth up, and that's very expensive. If you look at everything we need right now for bandwidth to level out across the university and all the community campuses, if I do a net present value for the next 50 years, if you gave us $25 million today, we'd have all the bandwidth we needed for the next 50 years. Well, how can you say that with technology being what it is? But that's the cost that we would have to pay to get the bandwidth that we need. And that cost is probably not achievable by us, but yet it stretches fiber to the communities. And so the question is, whose job is it then to build that infrastructure? It is the new infrastructure, as opposed to the traditional way of thinking about infrastructure. So I introduced the idea of SDI. What is it? Very simply, it's why do we do things the way we do them? Not what do we do, or cataloging how we do them and repeating to ourselves the way we've always done it. But why do we do it the way we do it? And this introspective look means sort of disassembling ways of doing business and then comparing with what we heard from the outside, what we're hearing from inside our students, and then looking at what other universities have done in other similar situations, what's worked and what hasn't, and importing the best ideas and adapting them to Alaska. That's what SDI is all about. And I've got a list here. I'll talk about emphasis across the UA system. If you're going to pay for college these days with the cost of going to college and then living your lifestyle at the same time, that adds up to quite a bit of money. Depending on whether you're in the dorm or living downtown or living at home, you're in the $20,000 a year category in round numbers. So if you're going to put that much money out for a degree in Alaska, you want value for that. You want to be able to become a critical thinker. You want to be able to get the degree. You'd like to get it in a short amount of time and not be extended in the process by happenstance that goes on in the university where the inability to get a course means you have to take a next semester, for example. When you have three universities in the state, it would seem that that shouldn't happen and that you can go online and take that course and get the credit and move through our system more rapidly. For the most part, we can do that in the earlier courses. When you start getting into your advanced courses or your graduate courses, it gets more difficult. But the direction is clearly going that way, and we need to be up on the forefront of that. Getting through is important. Spending more time in college is more money. And in fact, it clogs up the system because it's actually more expense to us. The cost per graduate goes up the longer a student spends in our system. There's an exception to that, and that's the fact that the majority of all our students attending some sort of class in the University of Alaska system is what we typically used to call a non-traditional student. In other words, they're not coming out of high school and going right into college. They're lifelong learners, they're single parents, they're working full-time or part-time, and they're trying to get the next level of higher education. That is a very important customer that also can be helped to move through swifter and easier without what I call the hassle factor. We think tuition's reached a peak. That's going to be problematic because that's a source of revenue for us that's very important. But for Alaskans, we're sensing that the idea of coming in and asking for 7 to 10% tuition increases every single year, those days are probably over too. Now, the problem with that is, since it is a main source of revenue, the less we ask for and we have to pay our bills, the more likely it is we're going to come to the legislature and ask for the alternative. What SDI is trying to do is, before that happens, we want to rearrange resources internally and take things from non-value-added work and put them over into the areas where we need the money. So a single appropriation, for example, is very important to the process of being able to move money internally at the discretion of the chancellors and myself before we have to come and ask for more money. Since we were here last year, I just went over on a couple of slides some things that were not in existence last year when we talked. And the advising, for example, that was a wonderful appropriation last year. We started out with a program at UAA that was using some technology applications with a test of about 400 students. We're up to over 5,000 students now at UAA that in the first and second year are fully advised with this system MapWorks. And any student that's taking basic courses or 100 courses, even if they're not going toward a degree, they're rolled in. We're now looking to buy the second investment, which would extend MapWorks to all the community campuses throughout the system. And this kind of what we call comprehensive advising has shown already in our system some improvements. And in the lower 48, where they've had it going longer, it's made significant improvement. Stay on track, an initiative we started in the last year, take 15 hours, get through faster. UAS had an 11% increase, which in the university metric system, 11% of anything is a pretty good number. They've had an 11% increase of students who signed up for 15 or more hours in a semester. That's a huge jump from what we were seeing before. UAF is already up over 7%. So just in this first year, we're seeing the progress. This system, MapWorks, comes with a module called Early Warning. Early Warning is an intervention process where we can go into a student who's having trouble, identify that student while there's still an opportunity for intervention, instead of finding out the next semester they just didn't return to school. We've had 65 successful interventions with students that probably would have dropped out. We've retained them. And, of course, retention is dollars to the bottom line for us. Partnerships with K-12, well, we've had some great meetings with the commissioner, with the state school board, our board, myself personally, and looking at specific things that we want to do to reach back farther and farther into secondary education and start students thinking about and working toward a college degree. And we can talk about a number of those later on, but Alaska Middle College is a great new program at Eagle River, 135 students out of the valley. FEA, the Educators of Alaska, trying to get teachers and focus on teachers and get the students when they're young and really energetic about being a teacher, and then holding on to them and bringing them all the way through, much like we do with programs like Rawhide or ANSEP for engineers. We want to put that same kind of emphasis on teachers internal to Alaska. So these programs and others are looking pretty good right now. Number of partnerships underway. That's one of our main themes, public and private partnerships. The Center for Mind Training here at UAS has been stood up. I fully expect that we will have three centers for mines, Fairbanks Interior Mining, the open pit type of mining. There are a number of explorations going on that look like they're going to go to development. The requirements for workforce in those, if they rack up according to the numbers that we're looking at, and we're going to the employers and asking for specific numbers, could be three times as many employees in those mines as we currently have, which means we've got a lot of workforce development, specific workforce development to do. And it's not the kind of training that can all come to Juneau, where you've got basically underground and hard rock mining training as opposed to the open pit. So Fairbanks looks like a good location. We may have over 6,000 employees in the mines in just a few years if some of these mines go into development. And that labor force is going to come from someplace. It needs to come, we think, from Alaska, and we need to be the ones to set up the process to train the workforce. Fisheries the same way. We've gone out to the fisheries, seafood, maritime. We've said, what do you need specifically in your workforce and in your degreed employees? And instead of just opening our doors and letting anybody come in and get whatever degree they want, we're trying to align ourselves more with what Alaskan employers in these areas specifically need and when do they need them, so that we can more appropriately channel and then start early, even in high school. And the governor did a great job when he talked to the class here in Juneau about the opportunities and then channeling those students and holding on to them all the way through until they're in the workforce or they've got that degree and become an accountant for a processing company. And again, we're creating our own focus and our own organization internally to handle all of that instead of letting all three schools just sort of do it helter-skelter, which is the way it's happened in the past. That's not an indictment. It just means we're growing. We're growing and we're getting more sophisticated about the way we deal with our employers in Alaska. I'll mention the P3 dining facility. The committees over the last 2 years have said, why aren't you out there looking at ways of commercializing some of your good ideas? Why aren't you doing more partnerships? Both of those things are happening. We've in the P3 dining facility at UAF is about $1.5 million project, which we did not come to the legislature for. We sold bonds. We got a good interest rate. We came in under what we expected to pay, and we'll use the profits from the dining facility to do the debt service on the bonds, and it's all being done internal with UAF and the board's approval. So here's an example of the first step we're taking in a real public-private partnership, and we're looking at others as well. You'll be happy to know on the bottom in the program review, there's an extensive and an accelerated program review looking at course by course by course across the universities, which ones bring value, which ones don't have the value, the general education requirements that are the basic courses for freshmen and sophomore. They've been different at the different universities, and our faculty have sat down through the leadership of the Faculty Alliance, and they've looked at GERs to try to normalize the GERs across our system. It's the first positive step in this direction, and this should be ready to go by fall of 13 for the students entering in fall of 13. Common cut scores, you know, we use AccuPlacer for everybody coming into our system for placement purposes. What we found out, though, is that a 51, and don't quote me on these numbers, but I'm close, a 51 in English at UAF would get you into one level of placement, but the same level of placement would require a 55 at UAA. It's the same test. Why? And we don't have a good answer for that. And so the faculty sat down and looked across the whole system and said, let's have the same cut scores. And they've just agreed to that, and now they're looking at the math scores for the same thing, for AccuPlacer. So I think significant progress in some of these system-wide anomalies that we used to identify is being made and will continue to be made through the rest of SDI. These are the five themes in SDI. I've talked about them here for the last 10 or 15 minutes. Of all the comments that came to us, of all the written items and the Fisher report and all the introspective looks that we've had, these comments all group under these five themes. Those five themes are in our budget, and you'll see them in the operating budget request. The next couple of slides are going to show a number down in the bottom right. This is the Board of Regents request. This is not the governor's budget. This is the Board of Regents request. And the slide details what's in that $1.6 million. Those are the details that in the Candy Stripe book you will find in significant detail in the back. But I think the most important thing is the idea of service to students. It runs replete through the whole SDI process. We're not here for ourselves. This isn't a jobs program for all of us. The only reason we're here is for the students, and we're here on behalf of the state of Alaska. We're public servants. If something's broken in the system, it's our obligation to fix it, and that's the attitude SDI is trying to imbue through the entire system, and it's working very well. I mean, the cooperation has been tremendous, and I attribute the chancellors and especially the work being done by faculty leadership in making these things happen. So within that, you know, enhanced services, mandatory comprehensive advising, I've talked about that. Interesting on the retention, completion, and graduation, the governor recently announced that he'd like to have 90% of the graduates from high school going to the university by 2020, I think it was, 2020. 90%, that's about... I mentioned the demographics say that high school graduates are going to level off, but this is the way you beat the demographics. I mean, if you could get 90%, that's the equivalent of 1,500 more students walking in the door. That's a lot of tuition. So we're delighted to see something like that out there. Now, that's going to be really tough to do because we've got to go back into the high schools and work real hard with the high schools. And the commissioner and I talk about this frequently. How can we provide the incentive and hold on to those students that kind of zone out, or the ones that don't do much their senior year when they have all that opportunity to be engaged? That's all got to happen before we can reach the governor's goal. But if we do, that's huge in terms of being able to pay without having to come here for general funds. A 1% increase in student credit hours, which is about 6,200 hours, if you figure each student comes in at 15 hours a semester. A 1% increase in student credit hours is about $1.2 million to the bottom line of the university. So with 1,500 new students coming in the door, times 15 hours apiece, I mean, do the arithmetic, that's amazing. And then if we can hold on to them and not have them wash out or drop out or quit or flunk out for whatever reason in their first 2 years, for every 50 first-time, full-time freshmen that we retain through the year into the next year, that's also about $1 million saved to the university's bottom line. So there's a lot at stake here. We can talk a little bit about MOOCs. That's an exciting idea. I'll mention, though, on this chart up in the top, you see P20W. For the first time, we got a $4 million grant that would allow us to populate a database that is usable by high school, and it's usable at the same time by the university, and it's a common database that both can use, and you have an application that can populate student by student by student the pertinent information about that student, such things as what courses did they take, what kind of grades did they get, what are their test scores, and on and on. I mean, we have a lot of leeway in terms of what we want to look at. But if you're trying to hand off a student from high school to college, the ability to go back in the high school and start working that student through with good advice, good advisors, talking to them about college education opportunities in high school and working with the student. We've never had a database before that we could do that. Student got a number when they enter kindergarten here in Alaska. They keep that number until they graduate from high school. The university doesn't get anything. We just get the student when they walk in the door. Technology, again, is going to allow us to be much more efficient in holding on to those students. Some great programs, Rawhide ran for teachers, for nurses, PETUS at UAS here for teachers. These programs work. These are good, these are excellent programs, and we support those. Partnerships with Alaska's public entities and private industries. I already mentioned going out to the employers and saying, what do you need, and channeling our students, and then being able to tell a high school student who hasn't made up their mind yet what course they want to take, what course of instruction they want to take, okay, here's the jobs that are going to be available, most likely available in 4 to 5 years in Alaska. Here's what they pay. Here's what the vacancy rate probably will be when you graduate, if you graduate in 4 years, for example. And start those students thinking about their life through college and into the workforce or higher education way early, and then getting them on the track in high school to be able to achieve, and realizing through some of these new programs that there isn't anybody that can't make it through. I mean, that Rawhide shows that. It doesn't mean that you can't make it if you come from a village of 90 people. What we're seeing is that with good instruction, good techniques, but the motivation to hold on to the students, which is so important, they really thrive and they do well. The last item, this bullet I mentioned before, holding on to the culture and history of Alaska. The UA Press probably prints about 50 to 52% of everything they print is culturally related. And when you're trying to preserve the culture of Alaska and breaking it down into its components across Native Alaska, Native Alaskan history, the UA Press is probably the single source beside our museums that does a really, really good job of that. And presses for universities are going by the wayside right and left. We think it would be a shame for the small amount of money that it takes to run the UA Press to have to lose that in budget squeezing. So I've personally made sure that the UA Press has gotten enough money to keep running, but they're operating on a shoestring, and would like to fatten that up a little bit. It's not big dollars. We're not talking about anything over probably about $200,000 a year to operate. I mentioned R&D. The focus here that I'd like to talk to specifically is we're not in a position to go out and compete with the other big name universities in certain fields of endeavor in the sciences or in the in the arts, because that's not who we are in Alaska. And if we try to compete with them on a shrinking federal budget where we get most of our research money, we're simply not going to compete. So you've got to play the right game here. And the right game is we are world-class leaders in understanding the Arctic, in understanding the outdoors of the Arctic, in understanding construction, engineering, and those things that are associated with supporting, such as the geophysical, the surface, the lands that we build on, the earthquake predictions that we need to, and understanding how and where we build, understanding the change that in the Arctic and in our area, anything that melts these days is getting a lot of attention, and we know more about that than most other people in Alaska. You've heard Alaska is like a litmus test when it comes to climate change. We've got people that's all they do is look at that. Unfortunately, they get most of their funding from the feds, and that funding is going to shrink. National Science Foundation supplies 42% of our research dollars. If sequestration kicks in round numbers, you know, 10%, that means 10% less, not just to us, but to everybody they give money to. So if we're going to get money from National Science Foundation, we've got to go in and compete harder with bigger, more important schools as they would be ranked in Newsweek or someplace like that. But the fact of the matter is the people in National Science Foundation recognize Alaskan researchers, and if we compete in those areas where we have the expertise, we will do well. And we've got a couple of examples. The $20 million EPSCoR grant we got recently, that was a huge win for us. And we competed with top universities all over the country for that. That teacher mentoring grant that we received for $15 million, there was only one $15 million grant in the entire country, and we got it. We can compete, but we've got to focus. We've got to pick our battles. The state has rarely contributed money to research, left it to the feds. But if we want to do Alaskan research and if the feds cut back, one consideration is should the state step in? What's happening to the kings in the river systems? What about ocean acidification? What's happening with result of in the deep oceans, the current changes that could affect fisheries? And on and on and on in those areas, that's where we can play. And the state normally has not been too involved. If the feds come back, what we're saying is the shingle's out, and we can do that kind of research for the state of Alaska. And if you compare where you're spending your money on research, a lot of it is going outside to outside consultants and outside researchers, and we can do that work. Here is a comparison between the Board of Regents budget that includes the items that we've just looked at and the governor's proposed operating budget. And you can see that aside from the compensation, which the guidance agreed to cover, and it does cover, it covers 90% of the new facility additions estimated operating costs. There was about a 10% reduction in that. But beyond that, in the program side, where the big blank white area is, you know, the program money came out of the budget. Now, this happened last year, too. This isn't a big shocker to us because it pretty much happened last year. And then we came here to Juneau, and we talked with the House and we talked with the Senate, and we won back item by item several, in fact, most of the items that were taken out last year. And they were not vetoed last year. We recognize that the financial situation this year is not the same as last year. And the one I'm really worried about is next year. So we're looking with great interest at what the possibilities are this year, because the trend clearly is going to tell us what next year is going to look like, and that's going to be the tough one. So there's some focus on, okay, if we're going to get it done, this is the year, because it isn't going to get any easier in coming years. And probably on the capital side, that's the where we would see that the most. But having said that, if you subtract out, you know, our high demand program requests in terms of an increment was about 0.8% increment over last year. And I think last year was about 0.7 or 0.8% over the previous year. So we've come in with a couple of pretty flat budgets, finely tuned. And if you throw in inflation, you've got a 0.8% increase, and you throw in inflation, it's really a decrease when you consider it. We are very appreciative of the fact that compensation and benefits were covered. That's a big number. But if you take that number out, there's not much left in the budget. And that's what this chart shows. I'll just say one thing about receipt authority. It kind of bothers me a little bit, because internal to the committee like this, you all understand that's kind of a mix of of internal dollars that we come up with and spend, but it's also the permission to spend dollars that maybe we don't even have, but it's the permission to spend it if we get it. When you add the two together and come down to the bottom, $579 million, to an external observer, it looks like those are real cash dollars, and in fact, they're not. They're that mix of maybe dollars and internal dollars. And so when we read in the paper the size of the budget, it's not exactly, in terms of actual dollars, as big as it looks over there on the bottom line. I know committee members understand this, but I doubt that the public does.
Just a moment, President Gamble, if we could have just a brief at ease. We're back on the record. Go ahead and proceed, President Gamble.
We're coming to the last part of the briefing, the capital budget. You're going to see talk about deferred maintenance. Here's where we address the cogen plant at UAF. And we talk about, through a chart that we have, the relationship between operating maintenance dollars, the renovation dollars. Those are the ones that come after a building ages out to a certain point, and then finally, when it rolls into deferred maintenance. And then we've got some capital research dollars as well to look at. Deferred maintenance, this is just sort of a scene setter in terms of what the size of the problem is. You know, normally if we were a single university, had one campus, one large campus, the number of students that we have, 35,000, would be on a much smaller footprint than we have here, where we have campuses all over the state. And typically what you would do with old buildings on a single campus is you'd tear them down and then build something else up on them. But your fixed costs would be considerably less. But because we are what we are to the state of Alaska with regard to our community campuses, we actually, per student, have to take care of more fixed costs because of more floor space. And as this shows, a lot of buildings, average age is 32 years old. And because it's been hit or miss with regard to operating and maintenance dollars and repair and renovation dollars over the years, over a 10-year period, more and more and more is going to deferred maintenance. And we're not buying that down either. So the size of deferred maintenance is getting so large that the actual dollar amounts that are required to mitigate the risk that all that deferred maintenance is building, with more and more and more buildings getting older and more getting deferred, the problem is becoming huge. I read an article not too long ago in the paper that said the state of Alaska has a billion-dollar deferred maintenance problem. Well, the University of Alaska is approaching the $1 billion, regardless of the rest of the state, and it's a serious problem. What we're essentially asking for is to try to get a programmatic approach instead of an annual effort to come in and spot dollars year by year by year. Try to figure out a way to get a programmatic approach to ensure that a steady flow of dollars over time will get a grip on this growth and actually bring it back down. On the way to that, you have, again, the Board of Regents on the left side, and you have the you have the proposed capital budget from the state on, from the governor on the right side. This is not a great chart because we are not asking for $233.9 million, but we had to figure out a way to display what the issues were in our capital side. And so we stacked them up under state appropriations because we didn't have another way to do this. The 37.5 at the top, we're in year four of the governor's five-year program to try to buy down deferred maintenance for the university at $37.5 million a year for 5 years. This would be year four. In order to actually bring the deferred maintenance curve down at the same time, the $37.5 million is sort of like treading water because the number's so big. It holds on to the level, but it doesn't decrease it, and at the same time, it doesn't increase very much, maybe a few million, very, very few. So we need an additional fusion of dollars to actually bring the number down from north of $750 million where it is now. That's the 75 that you see. We normally ask for 100 because 75 barely bends the curve, even when attached to the governor's amount. With 750 plus, it barely bends the curve. But what we asked for this year was a 75, but here's where the power plant comes in. We'll guarantee that out of the 75, instead of asking for another 22 to start the power plant, we'll take the 22 out of the deferred maintenance dollars and start the process of redoing the power plant in Fairbanks. So we're trying to show that here by saying that the cogen plant at 22. That's probably the number one priority besides the up at UAF particularly. And to go back a year, it's probably worth explaining that last year, I think it was then Representative Faircloth brought up an interesting issue. We were looking at the two engineering buildings, and we were looking at the power plant, and we were saying, okay, you know, we've got two competing high demands. How are we going to work this? And the deal we struck when that question was asked, internally we agreed that we would go after the engineering buildings because it was probably the last new buildings we were going to get for a while. It's the way we looked at it. But we needed to upgrade our engineering because accreditation was starting to look at our capability and our facilities and our laboratories, and they were not happy. And we had the opportunity last year because the number of dollars on the capital side looked like they were going to be healthy. So we decided to defer one more year on the power plant. And so this year is where you're seeing the power plant come in for the first time, specifically that $22 million. If you go down a little farther, you'll see in the left-hand column under state appropriations, 108.9. That's the second half of the two engineering buildings that were authorized last year to be funded halfway, and they both were at UAA and UAF. This completes the project here, the 108.9. And then you see some research, which we're fully capable of doing at the university, and to the degree the state is interested in answering some of the questions about these subjects, we think the state is, and we're, again, putting the shingle out there and saying we can do this. If you want this done, consider using the university instead of going outside and asking somebody else to do the research on these important issues. What are our priorities, though, bottom line? We know we're going to probably get the 37.5. The governor's been consistent so far, and there's no reason to believe that since he left that in his budget that we won't. So we think we'll get that. We would like to see the $22 million for the power plant, and we would like to get the other half of the engineering buildings. Beyond that, it's nice to have, but we're not expecting great things to happen this year, given the reports of what's available to you for capital this year. that's a heavy lift right there in and of itself, and those are really the issues that that we bring forward to you today. We can talk about the power plant in more detail in the question and answer session. So we're getting right near the end here. The going back to the well each year is just not working, because some years we get almost nothing, some years we do get nothing, then all of a sudden we'll get some dollars. But none of it is programmatic, and none of it is directly associated with the arithmetic involved in connecting to deferred maintenance. It's sort of happenstance. These are the three subject areas: maintenance and repair. That's this year's money to fix this year's problems. R&R comes at the 20-25 year point when you're rehabbing that building, or you're going into an older building and pulling out the asbestos and repurposing the building. And then if you don't do any of those very well, you end up rolling everything into deferred maintenance and kicking the can down the road. The only one that's really programmatic of these three is M&R. We usually get some M&R every year. But R&R and DM have been precious little other than what the governor has done. 2 years ago, we asked for $100 million. You gave it to us, but it was in receipt authority, and we were going to sell bonds. And that was reduced in the governor's budget at the end to $50 million of receipt authority. And we've sold half those bonds, and we're in the process of selling the second half right now and applying it. Of the deferred maintenance money that we got last year, we've put 71% of that on the street already. And over the last several years, we're at about 92% of the dollars that we've been given on the street, projects completed. So we put the money to work as fast as we get it in order to fix these things. I'm not going to talk about this chart right now. A couple of you have seen this before. It is the relationship and the history of deferred maintenance, maintenance and repair, and R&R, and it shows the connection between the three. There is a connection where one flows into the other, and what affects deferred maintenance and what doesn't. It's a complicated chart, and I'd love to talk about it, but I think what I'm going to do is let you know it's there, and then if we want to talk about this, we certainly can. I'll get off the stage by foot stomping research one more time. And recognizing again that the likelihood that the federal government is going to considerably reduce their outlays, and we've got to be competitive in order to get the dollars, as opposed to just sort of sitting back and letting them come in as they have in the past through the normal grant process. It's going to be a lot tougher. Outside dollars coming in get leveraged very nicely, as you can see on this chart here, about 1 to 5. Plus, we secondarily created economically about $400 million in business last year with the research dollars we got from the federal government that came into Alaska, the trickle-down effect, and that leverage amounted to a little over $400 million. And, Mr. Chair, that completes the budget briefing.
Thank you, Mr. President. Committee members, have some questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have three questions, two on the operating budget and one on the capital budget. The first one, you talk about 90% target by 2020 for Alaska students graduating, going to the university. How do you anticipate addressing the students in the dormitory area? Would that be taken care of through the construction, through the anticipated additional student tuition, or would that be a capital cost to the state?
That's a great question. I don't think we've had enough time since that announcement, since that goal was set, where we've even been able to go back in and answer that question ourselves, Senator. We're trying to expand the focus on freshmen, trying to keep freshmen and sophomores on campus as a help to retainment. And beyond that, our upper class, for example, here in Juneau, you know, they have to go out and look for a place to live. The So 1,500 is a nice number to look at and think about, but it does create some problems with regard to bedding those students down. How many of them need a seat in a classroom versus online, those kinds of things. We have not had the chance to analyze that. I think that goal was just created a couple of weeks ago, and we just haven't gone through. But it's a great question, and we'll take that back.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The second question on the operating budget is addressed at the ANSAP program. I just came back from the ceremonies this last Friday and had a chance to talk to Tom Case. But that program has a very, very high success rate with a lot of private support, and I'm wondering if you might comment upon it since you did not address it in your initial remarks.
I'd be happy to, Senator. ANSIP program has a long reach back. In other words, they start in about sixth grade, as you know. They build that computer. Herb Schroeder, who runs the ANSIP program, he struck upon a very, very important thing when he realized that we were losing students because they weren't motivated. They were getting glassy-eyed at the lectures and the classes. The curriculum in some cases wasn't relevant to anything they knew or were expecting to be involved with. But when they put their hands on something, and we see this on our undergraduate research all the way across the university with 20-year-olds, it's exactly the same as with the sixth graders. When they put their hands on something and they actually do something, it hooks them. And Herb found out that once you hook them, if you ever let them go, you lose them. And so the ANSIP program has a progression in which they hold on to those kids all the way through. And then even when they get into the college level, the cohort stays together. Those conditions have proven very, very successful, and those are the kind of conditions that we hope to apply in other ways when we're dealing with the high school, because that seems to work very well. It works particularly well for Native Alaskan students, but I think that the idea works well for all students.
Well, one comment, I guess, the other point that in talking with Herb Schroeder was that they solve their problems, which is different than the traditional system where a group of students, say six of them, work on identifying a solution instead of an individual student having to learn on his own. And I think that is one of the high success rates, which is non-traditional to the education system. But the other question that I have goes back to the power plant. Under the $22 million or the $75 million in the whole project, is that plant anticipated to be primarily from coal, or how would that be interfaced if in the next 5 years the state of Alaska had gas coming into Fairbanks? And is there anticipation that that would eventually be converted to gas, or once we go forward and have coal as our main source of energy supply, would that be the mainstay for the cogeneration plant in Fairbanks?
This is the $64 question, and it's a matter of timing and risk. The answer to your question is right now it looks like, because there is no solid commitment for gas in Fairbanks, it looks like right now it's going to have to be a high-tech coal plant, probably 30% waste and biomass, 70% coal, about 20 megawatts, $220 to $240 million total for the plant. If there were a commitment to gas, we would prefer to build a gas plant, because you cannot convert the coal plant. Once it's built, it's a coal plant, and you can't convert it to gas. We would prefer to build a gas plant. We're holding on as long as we can before we actually have to commit and start building something, because the plant is way past its useful life. You know, our fresh water system runs through the middle of that plant complex, too. The failure in the wintertime, I mean, it was 47 below a few days ago. All the research, the buildings freeze up, and as you know, you never thaw them out if you had a long cold spell. all those reasons raise the risk of holding on to this thing longer and longer. We took that risk last year to get the engineering buildings for one more year, but this year we've got to make a move on this plant. And one of the questions, and I would leave this up to a discussion among the senators, for example, is a new plant at the cost of $240 million just going to be for the University of Alaska Fairbanks? Should it be a university plant? Should actually the plant be a private or commercial or some kind of partnership that feeds the university but also has other benefits? I don't know. But that's an awful big number to go to the university alone. And I think we have probably within the next year got to make that final decision and start spending money on design. That's the $22 million. That's just design money.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman. Senator Myers?
Meyer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to follow up on that power plant, if I may. Because $240 million for one project scares the heck out of me. I mean, that may be our total capital budget for next year or years in the future, or maybe even this year. You know, it's way too early yet to even know how much capital money we're going to have. But I do know the whole city of Fairbanks, that whole community up there, has need for power. And for us just to focus on one little isolated part of Fairbanks, the college, and spend $240 million, that's bothersome. Because if we're going to spend that kind of money, let's not only heat the college, let's heat part of the city if we can. So that's my concern with that. And I know you're thinking about that. I know at UAA and even here at UAS, you know, they just write a check to the local utility companies to provide the electrical and the heating. And I guess that would be my preference at Fairbanks as well, if that's possible, if GVA has that capacity, and if we figure out some other source for heating, whether it be gas or hydro or whatever happens. So if you sense a little hesitation on this committee on going forward with $22 million, because you're right, that's only the design, that's only a small part of getting to the $240 million, I think you can understand why the concern. Certainly the engineering buildings, I think we all are committed to that. That's why we voted for it last year. But still, $108 million to finish both of them is going to be a high hurdle and a challenge. I do like the engineering programs that you have. I guess I would like to ask, though, and Senator Hoffman addressed the Alaska Native engineering program. It has been very successful, and I would like to see that expand. I know the oil companies are trying to hire more Alaska Native engineering students if they're here, and I think that's been part of the problem. And certainly our goal here is, our number one goal is to get more oil in the pipeline. So, you know, we are working with the oil companies to try to get that done. And so I guess my question would be to you, are you working with the oil industry as well to try to provide a local workforce, whether it be engineers or instrumentation, whatever the need is? And, you know, it's interesting, too, and all of us have given talks on campuses, whether it be UAF, URS, or Anchorage, and I'm not sure our students even know where the money for their schools come from, and that 90% of the money to fund the university comes from the oil industry, because a lot of times I'll hear them talking about, you know, supporting alternative energy, renewable energy, and all that's great, but that's still quite a ways away. So that's one question, and I know I'm rambling here. And the other question would be, you said tuition has peaked, but I think our tuition at UA or UA is still one of the lowest in the nation. I'd like for you to comment on that. And then I'd also like you to comment on what other sources of revenue, rather than coming back to the state each time when you need money, have you been pursuing, like alumni grants, land grants? I know we have a lot of land in the university. Have we been looking at selling some of that or leasing it or just other alternatives other than always coming back to Juneau for additional money?
Thank you, Senator. Briefly on each one of these, I talked with Alyeska and Exxon just last week, and in our discussions we talked about engineers. We talked about what their needs were. This idea of doing a gap analysis, this idea of getting specific about what do you need and where do you need them and when do you need them, so that we can focus the right numbers of people and then go back and tell the young potential engineers, hey, look, we know they're going to need you at this point in time if you want to be a mechanical engineer or a petroleum engineer. This is where you need to be when. Let's start you going. We've never had that continuum, that link, in our advising program, and it can go all the way back into high school. And so I think the opportunity, and you're right, they do hire BP. The other day I looked at a BP brochure, and they featured a lot of their employees in the brochure with their pictures and so on and so forth. And virtually every single one of them got their engineering degree or were involved in getting an advanced degree from the UA system someplace. And their CEO told me that we're the single biggest supplier of engineers for his company in Alaska. So the jobs are out there. And the other comment that was made by Exxon was, we don't get graduate engineers. You know, we want PhDs. They're very, very difficult to get a PhD engineer into a company like Exxon. Well, there are no scholarships for PhDs. I mean, you usually are a student attached to a grant from the federal government, and as long as the grant is alive, you know, your program is being funded and alive through your advisor. And that can be pretty disconcerting to have your program cut right in the middle of your PhD process. So the idea that maybe if they need PhDs, they would consider also providing scholarships for advanced students. And that's something they said they would take a look at. They're very interested in education. That's one of their themes, teachers particularly. So I think, and we're seeing a growth in engineering students. I mean, there's a nice, comfortable growth in engineering students. We have the engineering academies at some of our high schools now. I think the problem is being worked very well. And that's why we came to you last year and asked for those engineering buildings, because we're seeing this influx of interest in becoming an engineer, and the engineers in Alaska, when they come out of UA, they're getting hired and getting really good jobs. The tuition, you know, we peak tuition at 2%. That cost us, if I want to use that term, in opportunity cost, I guess, was a better way to put it. That cost us about $6 million from what we really needed from tuition. And we internalized that and just ate it. The chancellors all agreed it's the right thing to do. This high tuition and it's not sustainable at those kinds of numbers year after year after year. So we held it at 2%. We're still alive. We're still kicking. I mean, it's working. We found the efficiencies and it worked. I don't know how many years we can do that. Some legislations in the states are freezing tuition coming out of the legislature, or they're dictating what the tuition max will be. You all have seen fit to let us work those without reaching the point of frustration where you're legislating how we operate with our students, and we very much appreciate that, because that is not the case. There are 143 initiatives, the last I counted, out of 35 states where the legislature is dictating how higher education is going to conduct themselves. For example, there will be no remediation. Universities will not conduct remediation for students who are not ready for college. You will freeze tuition. You will cap tuition and so on and so forth. You've not done any of that. So we felt that's our job to do, and you want to see us do our job. That $6 million would have gone a long way towards solving some problems, but on the other hand, it may have allowed some more students to be able to go to college too, and that's the important thing. Now, in the western states, the WECHI, as they call it, the Western States Group, the Northwest, there are 15 universities in that group. about 6 years ago, we were at 106% of the average tuition. So we were 6% higher than the average of those 15 states. We were charging more, in other words. Today, we're at the 75% level. So we're three-fourths of the way down to the cheapest of all the states. So holding on to tuition and capping it makes us more competitive with those states for outside students. Now, we've not gone out and recruited heavily for outside students or foreign students. We have not done that. And to go to your third question, I think that's going to be an important way to get additional revenue. When a foreign student comes in, and China and India are two countries who are very interested in attending U.S. colleges, we're still the best when it comes to college education, particularly in the technical fields. They bring with them all the dollars to pay for everything. In other words, the margin on those students is better than the margin on a local student. And we're not recruiting them. There are some states in the Midwest whose universities you would recognize that are at 30 and 40% foreign students. And that's how they're making their tuition money, is heavily recruiting. I don't know that we want to go 30 to 40%, but I do think that's an area we need to look at in terms of increasing. Since last year, commercialization was of interest to both committees. We received questions on why can't you commercialize some of your ideas, turn them into patents, and so on. We stood up two offices, one at UAA and one at UAF, with LLCs. We have now two commercialization offices, and the number of patents that are being considered and awards for inventions and the potential for possible spinoffs are already starting to appear in sizable numbers, and we're pretty excited about that. That was something that was out there. It was a demand that wasn't being realized, and now that we've opened those offices, we're really starting to see some progress. You're not going to pay all your bills with those kinds of offices, but as you add things up, you put one layer on here and one layer on there, that could be important. And it also can create jobs in the state of Alaska, because we have entrepreneurs who are interested in looking at the commercialization of some of these ideas, which in turn could be a small startup, and that's jobs for the state of Alaska. So we are looking at alternative revenues. You mentioned the land grant, another interesting subject. We have less than 150,000 acres in our land grant. We're the second smallest land grant in the entire United States. There's a long history of ups and downs over giving the university more land, going through the Supreme Court, a couple of vetoes. It's a long trail. The bottom line is we don't have mineral rights and we don't have much land. And what we do earn of around $5 million a year is what we totally earn right now off of the land grant. About just short of $4 million out of that goes to the university scholarship program, goes to the UA scholars. The top 10% of each class of any high school in the state can be a UA scholar, and that's principally what funds the UA scholars program. The Cooperative Extension Service gets about $400,000 out of that. There's the cost of operating the land office, our real estate office and facilities office, which we combined into one office, that takes about $1 million. And that's the sum total that we get, compared to Texas, for example, who bring in about $400+ million a year off of their land grant for their universities. So I think we've missed the opportunity to make money off land as the Morrill Act intended. But I don't think we've missed the opportunity to do the equivalent of the dowry that we never quite got. And that may be something that we could discuss and look at contracts yet to be let in the oil and gas and mining world, that there is no contract, but there will be someday. What's the potential that in those contracts, without taking away from anybody else that's already getting royalties like the state or whoever, that some small percentage of that could be put into an account, not in violation of the Constitution, and out of that account could be appropriated a predictable amount of money each year. Something like that may, in fact, be the equivalent of what the original Morrill Act intended, and that was for the university to go out and make use of its land, develop the minerals, sell it, so on and so forth. I mean, that's not going to happen in Alaska. We've passed the point. We've divvied the land up in so many ways, plus we don't have the mineral rights, so the opportunity to do that is very limited.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your service to the state and the students in Alaska. I appreciate it greatly. On reviewing the Candy Stripe book that we have in front of us, could you please provide the committee an apples-to-apples comparison of student enrollment hours so that we can see whether your need has increased because of actual enrollment? Is that on a page already, Ms. Rizik? I found health numbers. I found engineering numbers, and maybe I missed. Anyway, if we could get that. And then as you spoke about the change in our students and trying to expand our thinking beyond a classroom and actually students in their seats, I'm wondering how many hours that you've presented to the committee, accredited hours inside of these occupations that you show us increase are online credits. So I'd like to know how many online credits versus in the classroom credits are there so that we can see whether there's a trend moving out of the classroom. And then as Senator Meyer expressed, I know that you compared West Coast tuitions in your comments answering the question, but I really would like to see an analysis of tuition costs comparative to other schools our size, that you compare us on salary issues and other things too, so that we get an apples to apples comparison with how our students are competing. Again, following up on Senator Meyer, the Fisher Report asked the university to consider multiple ways to increase its revenues outside of a request in GF funds to the state of Alaska. You have acquired a very dynamic individual in our state, Carla Bean, who is very connected inside of Alaska. And so I'm wondering what the growth has been since she's taken over the helm in outside fundraising in the different MAUs. May I continue? I have two others. I'm not expecting answers today, but I didn't want to surprise anybody. And if they're your questions, then you would know. On the PowerPoint that was presented today, on page 8, but I'm not going to my first one. On page 5, you talk about 500 degree programs. And then you've expressed to the committee your desire to expand further programs, and you've highlighted that we've moved from a master's degree to a doctoral accreditation in the Fairbanks area. And so I'm wondering if you could give me an analysis of the 500 programs, degrees, certificates that are offered, where students are actually accessing. So I want to know when they're graduating, if we could see a pie, and we were looking at your 500 programs, whether we'll see distinctions in what the students are actually enrolling in and graduating from versus what we have available. Does that make sense, a pie chart or a bar chart? And then lastly, I've noticed that you've been very careful in choosing your words that were three universities, and I appreciate that because there are walls and silos inside of each of those institutes, though our students and I, speaking for myself, expect us to be one university in a student's ability to transfer credits and after they've invested time as well as money and possible debt incurrent, that they would be recognized for at least a certain level of courses in year one and year two that would be able to cross through all of the MAUs. I understand that we accredit for higher levels in some programs and some campuses attract students like that, but at least at the entry level it's my expectation that we should have credits that could move. And I know the rural programs may even have additional barriers that I'm unaware of. And so I'm wondering what the costs for accreditations are and how many accreditations you actually do and what the duration is once you apply for that accreditation. Have I made myself clear if we apply for a program and that it's accreditation, how long is that good for and what's the cost to the university to apply for those? And is there any cost savings in one accreditation versus, and it may or may not be true. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
President Gamble, thank you for coming, and Michelle, thanks for backing him up. I was glad to hear you mention the UA Press funding in your overview. I'm a history means a lot to me, Alaska history means a lot to me, and I want to make sure that doesn't get lost. So thank you for that comment. Number two on my list, and these are just more some comments because I'm going to be requesting that the UA come by my office, not to take away from what little bit of time we have left here today. And Senator Hoffman has already covered one of my questions, and thanks, Senator, for asking that one. But number two, ANSEP, how's the expansion going into the biological sciences? I don't know if you can give me an update on that now, or that's a question we can discuss when you come by the office, but I'd like to know how that's going.
I'd like to take that one for the record and provide you more detail than I can do right now.
Thank you. Number three is something that I, in my former capacity here in Juneau, used to have on my wish list to get where we want to go, trying to diversify the funding for the university. I think I'd like to know what we're doing in heavy oil research, because I would like to maybe talk to my peers around the table about that. That's what we need to be looking at 50 years now. I agree the university needs to take advantage of our research capabilities. I champion your comments. We are leaders in Arctic research. We should be cracking the code and helping the industry on heavy oil. Second thing is, I think there's something we can do here as lawmakers. We have some authorization up to the tune of $500 million under AGEA. I think testing on pipeline protocol, permafrost, strain-based testing, et cetera, we should try to maximize that at the University of Alaska instead of outsourcing that to another university out of the state. Just comments. So I have some more. I'm not going to take away from those, and we'll catch those at the meeting, but thank you.
President Gamble? Did you wanted to answer one of those questions?
Senator Bishop, I'll have the staff arrange the time to be able to come back to you and talk in more detail on these. A couple of these, we'll go back and get some information, and we'll be able to answer those questions.
Thank you, sir.
You had said you wanted to answer one of the questions on the record?
No, I said we'll take it for the record.
Oh,
and
I got you.
Come back. When I get
okay.
The detail of health and bio progress for
NSF. I have a quick, Michelle, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I don't know, I have a short answer to her question about the enrollment. There is enrollment histories included on page 68 of the Candy Stripe book for the short answer, if members would like to look there. And then related to e-learning, we have 267 distinct degree certificate in endorsement programs that can be completed at least 50% online. Half of those are available completely online, and we have 1,400 distinct e-learning classes that were taught in FY12, which was a 34% increase over where we were in FY08.
Go ahead, Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted the contrast between, as we look at staff that's in the classroom, I'd like to break apart your total accreditation hours that you point to on 67 and understand how that looks on a bar chart, probably between 100% and what was in the classroom and what was out of the classroom, by at least some in big ways. And I'd really like to see that in where people are utilizing online big time.
Short thing on the power plant. I took a tour there a few years ago, and some of you have heard me tell this story.
There was a beautiful turbine up there, and it was installed. It was one of the original ones from, I think, in 1961 or 62 when the power plant was built. And there were some problems with finding parts for that thing because it was so old. And one of the facilities people said that they would call back to General Electric all the time. It was just a beautiful thing. It was like Art Deco design, and it had the big GE logo on it. And they would call back to General Electric from time to time, and they would ask for parts. And they were getting pretty hard to find parts for this thing. And they called one time, and the guy says, "Boy, I've never heard of that part before. You know, Ed probably knows where that, or Ed probably could find that part." And so they go and they start looking. They call back. They never hear back from the people. And what they found out was that Ed knew pretty much everything about that turbine, but he had died quite a few years previously, and the answer was Ed's dead, and they don't have a clue where to get that part. And I think that it just kind of highlights that you had something that was installed in 1961, and it was designed during the Stalin era in 1932 or something like that, and they've done a remarkable job of keeping that thing going. Problem is, it's going to fail. And you're right, it was 47 below. I think it was 53 below. The coldest I remember it in Fairbanks, some people said 72, but I specifically remember 68 below. And if that happens, not only do you have research problems keeping it going, but if you say you never thought out, well, yeah, you'll never thought out, but the fact is you'll never get research dollars again, because people will, that'll go through the research industry like a wildfire. Don't get your stuff going up in Alaska, because it's if it goes down, it's a huge problem. So, and to Senator Meyer's comments on the power plant, I think the idea of making it work with the rest of the community is a valuable one. You can't heat, though, because it would require doing steam heat pipes out to little neighborhood houses. The cost of that would be outrageous. But there's probably some opportunities that we could find to generate power in the area from that plant. And the last thing, too, is that, again, on the power plant, you can't just hook up to Golden Valley. And even if you could, that would only take care of electricity, because, as you said, that's where the water comes from, that's where the chilling comes from, that's where the heat comes from. And it was a remarkably designed facility at the time. Who would have thought that because you made it so efficient and so standalone that years later it would actually become such a big problem, because you can't fix one of the problems at a time. You have to fix the whole thing. Senator Fairclough?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on that point, I'm wondering about the regulatory hurdles and what risks it presents to Fairbanks and the university with just the regulatory hurdles that you will face in trying to license something like that. Are you investigating that, if I might, Mr. Chair, ask? Are we underway with the Board of Regents and the university looking at how we might license that facility?
We've already done the paperwork. Has been filled out and filed with ADEC here to look at the beginning of the environmental licensing. And that's been submitted. So that's the first step in the process. But we, having looked at other large projects in the state, anticipate that at some point, if we go down the path of a coal-fired plant, even though it may be using cutting-edge coal-fired technology with 30% being bio and waste that's being burned, will undoubtedly create some antibodies, and those battles have yet to be fought.
Senator Meyer?
If I may just follow up on that, and frankly, I have no problem with using coal, because there's a ton of coal in the state of Alaska, and it is close to Fairbanks up there. But I just have a little bit of a problem with UAF being a research-oriented university, being in the power plant business. And I hope that you've looked at the possibility of outsourcing that to somebody else. Let them have that headache, and you focus on research and education. Because I think Senator Fairclough, you know, has a good point that once we start going down this path, it's just going to be more and more headaches and frustrations for you that I'm not sure you need to take on.
The outsourcing, if I may, through the chair, we're talking about that, but if you outsource it, somebody's got to make money off of it. And the business case is not real strong right now for outsourcing it. It's unclear as to who would want to come in and take that responsibility financially with a good business case that looks at the long term and says, for the capital investment, we'll get the payback and then we'll start, you know, making money. Now, and this goes beyond my knowledge area, so I won't get too prescriptive here, but I also know that there are lots of incentives, federal and state incentives in the power business that all get woven into the business case. And so I only know on the surface that I've asked that question, and the answer I get back from UAF and Brian Rogers is that it's kind of iffy with regard to outsourcing. Whether it's commercially operated and owned by us or by the state and commercially operated, that's another level of possibility, but not one that I've sat down and listened to a presentation on, so I'm not even too good at talking about that. Most of what's been done so far has been under the assumption that the university would continue to operate it.
Could you, I didn't quite understand what that MOOCs was.
Oh, MOOCs.
Yeah, you said it was a database, but what's the value of it? What does it do?
You know, I've talked about this revolution in higher education. It's amazing how fast ideas are popping up about how to solve the problem of getting students into college and, more importantly, getting them out of college. And MOOC started with Stanford University. I mean, I don't think a year ago when we were here, we even talked about MOOCs at all. So, I mean, that's how new it is. And a professor from Stanford said, I'm going to put my course on computer science online for free, and anybody can sign up for it. And he did, and he got 160,000 students. Now, by the time he was done with the course, there were only 10% of the students left because it was a Stanford-level computer science course, you know. But nobody got credit for the course. Nobody took a final exam. It was putting knowledge for free out there that universities contain and format. And the idea is that knowledge belongs to everybody, and it doesn't cost us anything to let people educate themselves or use what we know. On the East Coast, MIT and a couple of other prestigious schools jumped on that and started doing the same thing. Last week, 40 more universities signed up to producing courses and putting them online for free. Now, our position is that MOOC is a massively online open course. Our position is, well, that's all nice, but how could we apply that here in Alaska? What's the reasonable application of something like that here in Alaska? And I'm speaking for myself now because I haven't run this through. I'm shopping this idea around. What if we could do the same thing with a couple of those basic courses that we're talking about that a freshman takes, the GERs, that, you know, we have a high attrition rate in the first year, math particularly, but science and English as well. We have a lot of remediation in those areas before they ever get into the first year. And we're trying to figure out how to work that. We call it the three critical years, senior year in high school and first 2 years in college, where just about everything happens. If you chart everything that happens to a new student coming out of high school and it forms a bell curve, the middle of it is the three-year period we're talking about. So what if we created, and a lot of people say Math 107 is a good example. I've never sat in Math 107, but it's a basic math course for freshmen. It's one of the first ones you would take that applies in general to a lot of degrees that you might undertake. If you're not ready for college and you walk in fresh from Math 107, you haven't done anything in your senior year in high school, you know, your chances of getting through it are probably not real good. So what if we built Math 107 as a MOOC and we actually built the college course, not how to take math, not how to pass Math 107, but Math 107, and we actually built it in the modules, and we used the latest and greatest high-tech presentation capability, things like the Khan Academy and some of these other really, really good upper high school and college presentations now are being done online. They're excellent, and the kids love them. And it's not lecture. And so you build this course, and you put it online for free so that the high schools, the counselors, the tutors, the parents, the instructors in math, everybody has Math 107, and you can back Math 107 all the way back to 7th grade, 8th grade, and start the fundamentals of what you have to know to pass Math 107 way back here, and put it into your curriculum. And it's like teaching the test, but you're teaching Math 107, piece by piece by piece. So that by the time you're ready to walk in the door at Math 107, and you don't get to goof off your senior year is full, and that's something I think we need to make sure happens. So that you're on your game when you walk out of your senior year, maybe even take a summer school course, and you're on your game when you walk in. But you've basically had Math 107. In fact, you've had it so well that if you're a sophomore in high school and you're really quick with math, and you've got it, you can go at your own pace. You know, you can go these lessons, you go at your own pace. If you're ready to test out, then you can take the final exam and pay the tuition fee that you would pay if you were a freshman and taking Math 107. Pass it, you get the college credit. And you can do that at any point in time in high school, not just one point in time, but any point in time. Do it for English, do it for science, the basic science course, or whatever the faculty determines fits that are the washout courses for freshmen. And now, if you do something like that, think about what problems it really attacks. The readiness to go to college is essentially what we're really after. And right now, what we do is we build bridging programs, and we've got well over 200 of these bridging programs to try to get students ready to go to college. Some of them have just a handful of students. Some of them, like Rawhide, are great programs, but they're all oriented toward the same thing, and that's getting students better prepared for their first 2 years in college. That's where all the attrition comes from, is those first 2 years. Is there another way to do it so that you don't need a bridging program because they're ready to go? I mean, that's what high school is supposed to do in the first place. Right. So maybe the application of a MOOC like that here in Alaska would work. And then it's up to each school how they would want to use it with tutors and so on and so forth. But parents can see them. Parents can review the lessons when they're helping their kids with homework. For the parents that can't do that, they're working full-time, working two jobs. You've got tutors. The schools provide some great programs. We've got a library program here in Alaska that helps with homework and provides tutors. But it all focuses right on those courses that a freshman is going to take and the ones that right now they're having trouble with. These are the kind of ideas that we're playing with that I think have some potential. We're shopping this idea around a little bit. We're trying to get used to it internally because this is a far reach from anything we've done before. UAS actually has fielded the first MOOC course that the system has, and it's something that we hold up a nice brochure and show, and you can take the course as a MOOC, but if you want credit for it, you can also take it as I forget the title of the course number, but you can take it and you know pay tuition and take the test. But I think the application of MOOCs, not just MOOC itself, but the application of MOOCs may be something that will really work a very, very difficult problem. And the nice thing is it puts every student, no matter where they are in our system, whether they're in the largest school district or the smallest school, it puts every student who can get online at the same level. They all have an equal chance because they're going to start way, way back here. What we've got to make sure as a university is that we can crank out teachers that are capable of teaching those lessons, including the fourth year of the governor's scholarship program, the more rigorous lessons. I think this has a lot of potential.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? We're just about out of time. Senator Hoffman?
Well, reaching back to the sixth grade, the model that you're describing in many respects is the ANSAP model. and which is very successful, but this one is much broader. The only other question I have is on contracts, labor contracts, where do we stand?
We are negotiating actively right now with 6070, which is essentially the facilities union, most of whom reside at UAF. That's an active negotiation going on right now, and I think there are
250
members in that. The other four, sad to say, the other four contracts are all coming up at the same time at the end of this year, this calendar year. And we're going to have to either agree with them to stagger that in some way, or we'll enter negotiation with the four remaining unions sometime, probably earlier than when the contract runs out, but at the same time. They've they've gone quite the distance with 6070 so far, but they are TAing articles in the contract, and they're moving forward slowly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you, President Gamble. We have tomorrow, we're going to have the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Jeff Jesse will present to the committee. And then Friday, we will have the Energy Authority, and they will present to the committee. President Gamble, Monday after next, the administration is going to be here regarding contracts that they have before them. Would you be sure and send a representative so they can watch that and kind of understand the kind of questions we're going to want to ask of you and your organization on contracts?
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Any other business to come before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.